ready. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. I got Ricky Addington and Chris Morgan.
Hi, what is it, the fifth best knitting podcast in the world?
What are you talking about?
We need a clever name if we're going to cross over into the knitting market.
We got to up our hobby section of iTunes numbers.
If any of y'all know a knitting hobby specialist, maybe someone that can knit some camo cloaks for my scouts.
Oh, they're cheap.
I think
now.
That's our entryway.
But we're going to talk about Xenos today. That's what we promised in the last episode. We'll talk about some of the Xenos changes for Warhammer 40K 8th edition in this episode. So thank you all very much for joining us. We're actually recording on a different night. I got a lot going on right now. I'm going to be in London for the next 2 weeks. So our recording schedule will be even further altered. But anyway, there's a lot going on. So now we're recording on a different night. That's why we have Ricky and Chris here. And we're talking Xenos.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess let's just jump right into it, because I'd like to talk about the orcs, for instance, and how their WoG and mob rule gives them benefits in 8th edition. I think that these things have become innately 8th, and they're good. I mean, they fit right into the context of where the game works now.
And they're extremely thematic when you think about how orcs work in any kind of narrative that you see an orc in. The more boys there are, the braver they get.
That's what we want, right?
Yeah, and that's the absolute way it should be. They should not give a crap that 30 of their dudes just died. They're still going for it. And so the leadership tests, I'm a big fan about the fact that morale is not an issue for them as long as they're in a big gaggle.
Well, let me read a couple of their abilities here. They've got, here we go, and a unit with this ability can reroll failed charge rolls. So that's pretty strong for the units that have that. And then the mob rule, a unit with this ability can use a number of models in their unit as the leadership characteristic. In addition, a unit with this ability can use the leadership characteristic of any friendly orc within 6 inches.
And that doesn't mean just characters. That's any friendly orc.
If there's
a pack of knobs or something nearby, you would expect knobs, one, to have better natural leadership, and two, to keep the boys in line.
So just to clarify on that, let's say I've got a group of boys that are down to like 5 boys, but then I've got a group of boys right next to them that are like 30 or whatever. So that group of 5, their leadership would be 30, right? Because they're next to that unit. Am I correct in that?
A unit with this ability can use the number of models in their unit as their leadership characteristic. And then that's period. So that their leadership characteristic no longer capped at 10. No characteristic is capped at 10.
Right.
Put that out there. In addition, a unit with this ability can use the leadership characteristic. So two matching phrases here of any friendly orc within 6 inches.
So you get one knocked down and they're weak and susceptible to a morale test. But hey, if they're close enough to a bigger unit, they can use that unit's morale. So they still don't care.
Yep. So the TLDR for that is you're going to need your extra strength fungus remover to get rid of all these boys.
Well, you got to clear out pockets within 6 inches for sure, you know, just to prevent that kind of thing from happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think your primary thing is just don't ever plan on forcing a morale check against them. But if you do, make sure, you know, you somehow pull them away from the 6 inches away from the other squads.
Yeah, and most of the orcs have the here we go and the mob rule.
And here we go is such an excellent rule.
It's huge, too.
And it goes across pretty much the entire army. Like, how many armies out there have almost every unit with reroll charge distance just naturally?
I'm still scrolling trying to find one that Gretchen don't have it. Oh, darn. That's the first thing I found that doesn't have it in their rules. That's crazy. It's almost army-wide. You're right, Chris.
Yeah, the Jets, I don't think, have it. But, you know,
the Jets.
I imagine that most vehicles don't have mob rule or here we go. But,
hey,
you
look,
know, just
all models act the same way now, Chris. That's something that we need to kind of just process, is that everything has the same set of rules. So, you know, that Defcopta has the here we go and mob rule. I know it's not the same as a Jet, but I can see a Burnabama wanting to get in there and mix it up.
I'm looking at the Blitzabama, and it doesn't have it. So, you know, there's obviously some discretion put into how that works. But at the same time, I also feel that these rules are definitely not held back from the ones you expect to have them. Of course, you know, like war bikers have it, and war tracks have it.
Yeah, basically everything on the ground, I think, is ground-based, has it for sure.
Can we all just agree that it was a miss on GW's part to not make a rule that says that orc flyers can only charge once. I feel like there's no coming back from that. You know what I'm saying?
See, that's why they needed to have the "Here We Go" in the mob rule.
I'm pretty sure that that's just a straight dive bomba.
Yeah.
And it just it lands the one time and then never moves again.
The Killer Cans don't have "Here We Go," but the Deaf Dreads do.
Oh, boy. Dem Dreads.
Deaf Dreads.
There's a lot of talk about massive dread mob armies.
Oh, you ain't lying. I want to have a bonus one, or I'll maybe make a video of the about 11 Venerable Dreadnoughts and 2 Tech Marines.
Well, I mean, if there's anything that the Paul Murphy can do, it's beat a good thing to death.
Well, it's fluffy. It's fluffy Iron Hands. It's Iron Hands.
It's completely Iron Hands.
Good.
Okay, if we can to make one quick segue just a little bit, the Force Orgs, the detachments, the Force Orgs in the book allow for themey armies. And they may be choosy. Some of them could be a little excessive. But the Force Orgs, they aren't really, there's so many of them, they aren't really restrictive if there was something that you were playing before that you want to try to mimic now.
Yeah.
With actually paying points for things.
I was really concerned about that, you know, when they start talking about detachments and all this. And, you know, because we all have all these models that don't necessarily fit into like a normal, you know, like what we're used to it for a CAD, remember? And so I was super worried. And then when I started looking at it, and I mean, they weren't kidding. If you have a detachment in mind or certain models in mind, you could make the army out of it. Now, hey, you may not max out on, you know, command points, but you're getting it in there. And I'm pretty excited about that. I was very happy with that.
No, I think that's an incredibly good point. I mean, my test game, I was on the back foot for the command points because of the way I had my army structured. And I tell you, It was a different experience knowing that I had to be very, very cautious with how I spent them, only spending them at the right moment. And anybody who takes a kind of list that limits your command points in that sense by not taking what you would consider an all-rounder sort of force, you've got to do it. You've got to do it only when it counts. You can't be frivolous about it. You know, you're never spending a command point on the lucky chance you'll get that 1-6 to ignore a mortal wound or something.
Yeah. You know, just to get back to orcs, though, like, it must feel real good as an orc player just for the simple fact that they're not going to be burning those command points to reroll a charge.
Yeah, or leadership, unless something goes dreadfully wrong.
Oh, yeah, because it's like, what, is it two?
Two command points to avoid the leadership check.
So orcs, I feel like orcs are going to have a stockpile of them that, you know, compared to some other armies, because you're not needing them for charges because you can't reroll a reroll. So almost everything in here, you're getting to reroll to charge. You're hardly ever going to worry about morale. So they better come up with some more creative things for orcs to use them for, I guess.
Well, you can reroll the first turn if you need it for the CZ initiative. Maybe reroll the random game length if necessary. Those are two very important things I could see an orc general maybe wanting to do.
Yeah. And there's still some conjecture on that, isn't there? I've seen a lot of Facebook groups kind of discussing whether that is or isn't a thing. But
I don't want to debate that.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something that we will see event organizers making their own decisions about how they want that interpreted at their events. And without like an FAQ type situation, you know, I don't know. I just say right now by the rules, by the actual, what the words say in the book, that seems like it's possible, but I don't want to hang up through that. I want to talk about gene stealer cults.
Okay. I mean, if we have to, they're disgusting and gross.
This is the Xenos episode. So we got to talk about the non-imperial stuff. I shouldn't say Xeno. We're going to talk about everything within the context of 8th edition. And we're of course going to get to everything we possibly can. But one last point on the orcs is that they have a couple of very distinct advantages that fit them. That's what I was talking about. It's very much in line with the way this edition is, and they aren't disadvantaged from the get-go. Like their army book entries here have a value and a place within the scope of the game, and I think that's really nice design.
That right there is a win. 8th edition is a success in the simple fact that the Gorkonaut and Morkonaut are now playable.
Well, that's still up for interpretation, I think, with some of the stuff. I don't know that they are incredibly efficient, but what we heard about on one of the streams that GW did was that the Stompa, when it explodes, it really, really explodes. Yeah, it explodes on a 6. It explodes
on most a six vehicles. And 2d6 within 2d6 suffers d6 mortal wounds.
Yeah. On a 6, it explodes, and each unit within 2d6 suffers d6 mortal wounds.
Man,
so just think about that. The Stompa has 40 wounds, right? And you probably want to equip it to just send it in headlong into combat, because I don't think that it is bogged down by infantry with the bigger and stompier rule. And it doesn't start degrading in efficiency until it takes 10 wounds, right? So it's going to be doing damage for a long time. And then when it finally gets blown up or removed to zero wounds, then you might take a few more of your enemies with it.
Yeah, I mean, I could see a point in the game where when you're hoping this thing just goes up in the middle of a big ball of infantry and takes everything with it. So
you want it over there on, the last turn of the game.
Yeah.
With their
on
one,
an objective.
their one space marine is hanging out near the relic or something.
Oh, this is awkward for you. I'm sorry. But they're gone.
So we'll talk about Tyranids and Genestealer cults. But I like to kind of jump into the Genestealer cult because their cult ambush is different than it was before. It works like reserves now, right? I mean, can we, and the reserves is if you wish to go into cult ambush, table for the Genestealer cult character, you can pick one friendly Genestealer cult infantry unit that has also set up an ambush to arrive with them. Make one roll for the cult ambush table and apply the same result to both units. So I think I skipped over that. You basically have a cult character and a cult infantry unit that can go into the cult ambush. When they arrive from play, the first one through three on the cult ambush table are kind of what you would expect, set up within 9 inches and you have some other restrictions. And on the 4+, I guess on the 5+, it starts to get a little bit more interesting and a little bit more deadly for your opponents. On the 5+, it's a deadly trap. You can set the unit up anywhere that is more than 9 inches away from the enemy models, and then it can either move D6 or shoot with its range weapons, as if it were the shooting phase. So depending on how you equip them, that can be deadly. But the move, the extra D6, is one of those things we're going to talk about. We're going to have a section of things that let you charge easier that we'll talk about maybe later in the show if we get time. This is one of them. And then they came from below, set up within 9 inches from the enemy model, any other enemy models. And then the unit can move normally, even though it has just arrived as reinforcements. That's strong because you're going to get your full movement, therefore putting you a lot closer in case you want to charge in the assault phase.
And that's really where the money is that 9 inches, I think, is a very deliberate point for GW. Not even a drop pod, right? Drop pods are typically like the safest way to get close to an enemy without hurting yourself. Even the drop pod, notorious in previous editions, has to follow the 9-inch rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like if you got an MSU type army, you can really just spread them out though, and really mitigate that though. That 9 inches. I mean, even though they can still move and they're going to be able to charge. I mean, well, unless they roll like Paul Murphy, they're going to get the charge off.
I need that extra 6 inches to get up there.
Exactly.
And yeah. I may have butchered it before. You know, it's not tied to a character. Is it during deployment you can set up a unit in ambush instead of on the battlefield? At the end of any of your movement phases, it can launch an ambush. When it does so, roll. You can attach a character to that unit and get the benefit of the same roll.
Yeah. I guess my issue is that, if your opponent has a lot of stuff on the table, though, they can kind of castle up. I mean, because they still have to be placed within outside of 9 inches, even though they can move up. If I put units, spread them out 18 inches, within 18 inches, they can't be placed in there. So it doesn't matter that they're going to get to move up though. So as an opponent, they can really kind of block you off from using your cult ambush, to come up inside.
You just gun up some holes.
Yeah.
Gun up some holes in the units for you to charge on through.
I mean, because that's another thing to remember is that Genestealer cult, right, just like everything else, half the stuff has to stay on the table just, at the start of the game. So now, I mean, they have that ability to maybe offer some punch. But I tell you right now, more than any other army, Genestealer cult make me grateful that Overwatch can be done more than once in a turn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what we were talking earlier in one of our chats about flamers on tanks.
Right.
I'm telling you, right. Any Baneblade variant with 4 sponsons with twin heavy flamers, that's 8d6 shots auto hitting on Overwatch. I'm gonna use Baneblades.
Anti-Genestealer cult.
Yeah, that's my anti-charge.
You heard it here first on FTN. Baneblades are good against the Genestealer cult.
There's your Baneblade. This is Ricky Addington. Now,
well, Andrew's not here for the grandiose edition statement. So,
oh yeah, I have to make it. I have to make it.
I appreciate you stepping up to the plate. There,
here we
Ricky.
Go. I'm gonna make the most outrageous comment of 8th edition, and that's that Baneblades are the greatest melee unit in the game. There. I said it. They're the best counters in the game.
Oh, and you know, I don't want to take us too far off here, but with the cold ambush, and I know we're talking very, I guess, nice about some of this stuff within the context of just that exists. I'm happy this stuff exists. I'm very excited to be playing 8th edition and have this all new stuff laid out in front of us. And it's all the stuff that's out and it's going to be coming out. You know, it's up for pre-order now and you're going to be getting it on the 17th. It's going to take a lot to get through. So we're going through the parts that have changed the most, or even maybe oddly similar, or that just may seem effective on the first run through, the things that you might want to involve in your game immediately.
Yeah, there's an incredible amount of information to sieve through here. And even say when a new book comes out, like Death Watch, or when Gene Steeler Cult first came out, we devoted a week or two just to the one book. Well, now we have everything at the same time. Like this is an all-you-can-eat buffet of 40K goodness.
Yeah, so forgive our excitement for some of the stuff that that may not seem too exciting to you, but I think I'm very enthusiastic about all the changes and how it all kind of plays and figuring out what the best combos is for the base rules of the game. And I'll also point out Gene Stealer Cults get my standout unit of the Sentinels.
Oh my gosh, here we go. Here we go.
Snapped and armored Sentinels in their base army list.
And they're not terribly expensive so far as units go.
Are their Sentinels different?
They don't look different to me. I don't know what the points, I haven't looked at the points on them, but they do not look different to me.
Yeah, I mean, faction keywords, Tyranids, Gene Stealer Cult, yada yada.
Other than being Tyranids and Gene Stealer Cult.
But they're power level 2, right? And I think that the only other thing I've seen at power level 2 were Gretchen. So
The armored are 3 and the scouts are 2.
I mean, they're toughness 5, they got 6 wounds, they've got a single attack and a 4-up save on the cult scout sentinels.
It's 35 points for the scout sentinel.
So it's the exact same as a sentinel, it's just different. Yeah, just different faction keywords.
I do honestly feel, though, that this is going to add some good stuff to the Gene Stealer Cult book. That just that, like a 35 points, right, for a 6-wound vehicle.
That's without a weapon, but I'm with you.
Without a weapon, right. But, you know, you put a heavy flamer on there, and that's, what, 17 points? Am I remembering that correctly?
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah. Oh, and you know what would be great about that, Chris?
Hmm?
You would be super good at preventing assaults.
You would be super good at preventing assaults. But you'd also be very good at running up and burning people to death. Because remember, flamers are assault weapons. You can advance and shoot them, and flamers hit automatically. So you have the Scout Sentinel with a 9-inch move plus D6 with an 8-inch range on a flamer. You can just burn somebody out.
Wouldn't that be so embarrassing, though? Like, coming from, like, a long-time player, you know, and you're just there thinking about Sentinels being junk, and then you just lose your whole game because somebody runs 3 table. Scout Sentinels.
Yeah, you roll up to the table, and you're like, oh, this joker brought all these Sentinels.
That would be so awkward.
You're playing Corn Berserkers, and the Sentinels burn you up.
Dying to Sentinels. Oh, that'd be great. I need to stock some of these in the shop.
I'm thinking of something similar for land speeders. You know, double heavy flamer on a squad, like 3 land speeders moving up an insane amount, advancing, and then just burning people.
They don't instant die now, though, to combat. So, I mean, they're not as, you know, squishy. So
let's go over to Tyranids, since they're so close to Gene Stealers. The keyword sharing is kind of interesting. The fact that Gene Stealer Cults have the Tyranid keyword, you know, I think that's going to be a benefit for some combo army list in the future. Well, let's talk about Synapse. Their abilities, the base is Synapse, and this has changed a good bit over the generations of Warhammer. But what it does now is that High Fleet units automatically pass morale tests if they are within 8 inches of a friendly High Fleet unit with this ability.
I mean, that we've talked about this a little bit before during the previews, but any time an army can ignore that role is a good time. Like that is an extremely strong rule. And Synapse has had its ups and downs. Like you said, I remember, and I'm sure you remember too, Paul, back when Synapse used to give every model under Synapse Eternal Warrior.
Yep.
That was so annoying.
That was super annoying. And it made no sense. It's like, my brain power prevents you from dying.
It's the will to live.
by that standard, I should never die. Just throwing it out there.
Depends on what edition you finally expire in.
That's a- yeah, I guess so. But they also simplified instinctive behavior, because you remember in 6th edition, instinctive behavior was one of those things. Is like, all right, do I lurk? Do I, what do I do?
I still never figured it out. I was like, just roll dice and tell me what's going on.
Yeah, almost. Wait, I mean,
a 90% one is bad.
Yeah, 90% of the people out there play Tyranids. They just trusted their opponent to do the right thing.
Well, I knew when it triggered. Like, I obviously was like, if my opponent wasn't rolling when they were supposed to, I knew when it asked them to roll. But I still had no idea what the outcome was supposed to be.
No, yeah, none. None whatsoever.
I don't remember anyway. It's just been too long since you didn't play many of them, right? I mean, we have some good Tyranid players in the area, or I should say, we have a good Tyranid player in the area, but if he wasn't playing Tyranids that weekend, then, you know, it was easy to forget the rules.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, one of my best friends in the world, he is a Tyranid player, but 7th edition had him definitely searching for a new codex. But I feel like they finally got Synapse and Instinctive Behavior. I think they feel right. They feel like what they should feel like now.
Let me tell you what Instinctive Behavior does.
Yeah, go ahead.
Unless a high fleet unit with its abilities within range of the Synapse ability, see above, of any friendly high fleet units, it can only target the nearest visible enemy unit if it shoots, and if it charges, it can only declare a charge against the nearest visible enemy unit.
It's so simple, it just might work.
Well, let me tell you, this is important, because you can't fight, even if you consolidate into someone, you can't fight them unless you charge them.
Yeah, that is a very important point, and that's especially important for things like heroic interventions. So if you're getting charged by your opponent, and you have characters that heroically intervene, the characters weren't charged, they can't be hit in the combat.
So a whole charge in the nearest enemy unit, it means that it can only declare against that one unit, so that you may be able to, you know, pull some shenanigans. I don't know what that is yet with the tactics or how the movement will actually work on the table, but I think that's an important thing for us to clarify or to call attention to.
Yeah, it may sound old by this point, considering how long the Tyranids have been in the game, but target the Synapse creatures, guys.
Figure out. Yeah, let's make little hats for them. This guy has Synapse.
A little top hat and a monocle, I say.
As part of you have your objective markers and hats for your Tyranids. To put on your opponent's Tyranids. You know, when you
I'm getting flashbacks to Spaceballs. Hello, my honey.
What do you order? He had the special. That's what I ordered.
Another big rule is the
not
shadow.
Again.
Shadow of the Warp. Sure, Shadow in the Warp. Enemy psychers must subtract 1 from any psychic test they make if they are within 8 inches of any units with this ability. Tyranid psychers are not affected.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, Shadow in the Warp is one of those things that has also gone through a lot of changes. All of the Tyranid special rules have really just changed in variety over the years. And
yeah, same names, totally different effects.
Yeah, I mean, almost completely different from edition to edition. And of course, since the psychic phase is so different now, you would expect something like that to happen. But I remember Perils of the Warp just being so utterly frustrating when you have to pass a leadership test on 3 dice to get your powers to work. So frustrating.
Agreed. But I think this is that the I think it's very important here for me to get this right, because the terminology is very important. Enemy psychers must subtract 1 from any psychic test they make. It's not a +1 to the difficulty. It is a subtract 1 from their role. And I think the reason I'm calling such distinction to that is because when things... I don't believe that there's a rule that says like 6s always hit or something. Right.
No, there's
right.
Ones always fail.
Exactly. Because now one of the key mechanics in 8th edition that you're going to have to wrap your brain around is that the modifiers happen at the end of the math. So if you're like an orc Luda and you normally hit on a 5+, but you move, so now you hit on a 6, because you roll a 5 and it's -1, so that becomes a 4. But even if you roll a 6, if you moved and you're shooting at a flyer, that's a -2. That's still a fail.
Or if they pop smoke or something like that, you had to move. Exactly. And they pop. I mean, there's the way the modifiers apply is something you. I think they've got some consistency in here, but I think it's not something to take for granted and to really look at how that works for your stuff. And thankfully, it's all on the same data slate.
Weird.
I'm saying, I think they did a pretty good job with that.
I'm inclined to agree. And I think that so far as a almost uniquely 8th edition thing, that's going to solve so many problems. Do you guys remember, I certainly do, the whole debacle about our Thunderwolves really strength 10 on their power fists? You remember how many hours were spent arguing on that, the comment
threads? I just rolled the dice and said it's strength 10.
It depended if I was playing them or playing against them on what strength they. I would argue. If I was playing
a Dark Angels player.
Hey, I am not ashamed to admit that I went to a tournament. You know what? No, I am ashamed to admit it, but I'm going to say I put Dark Angels Tech Marines on a Thunderwolf one time. And it's Paul Murphy's fault, though. So, you know, blame him.
Puppy.
I tried. I looked everywhere to find some lions that would have worked and, you know, tried to make it, you know, somewhat Dark Angel themed. Couldn't find them. So I just had to bite the bullet.
Just saying the modifiers are important and all that stuff. Let's talk about some other Xenos stuff. Can we do that?
Lay it on me.
I mean, I was still going down some of the Tyranid stuff.
Oh, you got more Tyranid stuff you want to talk about?
Oh, no, I was just checking out their psychic powers.
Yeah, well, that's for another episode.
Yeah, okay. All right, who we hitting next?
Kraftworld Eldar.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man.
Here we go.
They've got
everyone's favorite.
Right, yeah, jet bikes. You know, it turns out, I think they're about the same points, but they're different, you know, altogether. So when, you know, that's not what people are worried about right now. But Battle Focus. Yeah. Battle Focus and Ancient Doom. Yeah, the craft world keyword, you can be from a certain craft world that may matter. But the Ancient Doom is you can reroll failed hit rolls in the fight phase for this unit in a turn in which it charges or is charged by a Slaanesh unit. However, you must add one, this is where another, you must add one to morale test for this unit if it's within 3 inches of any Slaanesh units.
Mm.
Situational?
It's always been situational. I guess yeah. Since it's existed, it's been situational. But the reason I kind of wanted to talk about this specifically is because it has that. You add one, and it's not a minus one to your roll. It's you add one to the morale tester. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And that doesn't
sound you're never like going to roll that one.
It's not a minus one to your leadership or something. You add one to the morale check.
That doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but just I always read that as, like, ever since I started playing Age of Sigmar, I'm going to read that right there as I'm losing one additional model.
Yeah,
that's how you read that.
Yeah, and until you pick off something important that you knew you were going to need next round.
Yeah.
So then the battle focus is way different. This unit can shoot in the shooting phase as if it hasn't moved or advanced, with the exception of heavy weapons.
Yeah, moving with heavy weapons is something that a lot more people are used to, just the layers and layers of exceptions that were built into the rules up to this point. Where, a vehicle can move this many inches and ignore the penalty for shooting heavy weapons and modify ballistic skill, blah, blah, blah. No, it is just straight up, unless you have something on your data sheet, you don't have the exception to this. And that includes scat bikes.
Indeed.
And that's one of the things about when I was looking at this, Paul, I was specifically thinking of you. Back in the day when the heavy weapons and all the jet bikes became a thing, and you were 100% gung-ho about the shuriken cannons over the scatter lasers.
Was my preferred.
They're even better now.
So anybody that was ahead of the game, you were ready for 8th.
Yep. Basically, Paul Murphy was ready for 8th edition 2 years
ago. 2 edition. Yeah, yeah.
I just love that rending, man. As you just said, so many times I dug out from a bad situation with some rending. But let's talk about the Seer runes. So I'm going to talk about Eldrad specifically. He has Runes of the Farseer. Once in each phase, psychic phase, you can reroll any number of dice used for Eldrad Ulthraean's attempt to manifest or deny a psychic power. So once per psychic phase. Not in everything, or not in every time kind of thing.
Well, and that, considering that now you're not having to worry about rolling 15 sixes with your 30 dice psychic pool, that makes the chances of that happening a lot greater.
And the Ghost Helm, this is strong. Whenever Eldrad suffers a mortal wound on a 5+, that wound is ignored. It's not when he suffers a perils and a mortal wound. It's any time he suffers a mortal wound. Now, and let's also talk about how damage works, because you roll, let's say Smite does D3 mortal wounds and you roll a 3. Eldrad then has to roll 3 times to ignore those wounds.
Better than not getting the roll any times.
Yeah, but if you rolled a 3, Paul, he'd take 2 mortal wounds.
But he probably would. by the odds, by the odds. But I'm saying that's how.
But no, yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, and that's huge. It's a big distinction. There is, it's for every mortal wound. The way mortal wounds happen. If you take six mortal wounds, Eldred gets 6 5-up saves. So that's huge because mortal wound mitigation is very rare from what I've seen so far in 8th edition. So that makes him way tougher.
Unless you're Nurgle.
Yeah.
Or, very, very common among Nurgle things.
You have 360 brimstone horrors laying around.
Regular Farseer also gets the Ghost Helm. I don't think that you're, like, these guys are not combat monsters, so you're not expecting them to do a lot of tanking on things. But Eldred does have 6 wounds. And, I mean, that's not a small amount of wounds on a character.
Well, you remember, Paul, like, in editions prior, the wound marker would indicate the toughness or the importance of somebody, and it was 4 wounds from last edition previous.
Yeah.
Now it's 6. 6 yeah. is that number.
The average wounds on a character is about the 5-ish, so anything above that signifies better, way better, a magnitude better, I think.
Yeah. So 6 is going to be like your stand, like not your Primarch level, of course. I mean, Gilliman is very deliberately not 10 wounds. But
then Mortarion is going to be, you know, 12, 15 wounds.
Oh, I bet you're excited about that.
Very excited.
But you know what I'm excited about in the context of Eldar? And one very, very cheeky, deliberate thing I'm sure that the person who laid out this book did was put Wraithblades and the Wave Serpent on the same page. Just throwing it out there. I'm super hot on the Ghost Warriors.
No, they're good. They are very good. And Wave Serpents are
3 wounds each.
Yeah, Wave Serpents are also very good with the ability to lower the damage that they take.
I mean, I don't see a situation where a Wave Serpent isn't going to be able to deliver its cargo without some serious heavy firepower.
Dedication, right?
Yep.
I know we're not doing a full, like, faction review here, but I do want to point out the Wraith Knight is still a beast, and he's every bit as scary as he used to be. But it's actually more difficult to, like, get layered charges off with the way things work now and some of the power that Eldar have. Eldar are still very powerful. And the Wraith Knight comes in at 24 wounds.
That's a hefty number. But he's also, I think, better pointed or more fairly pointed than he was last year. So
What'd he go up to? I haven't even checked.
Is he base 500?
500?
Yeah, I think he's base 500.
Wow. Okay, yeah.
Sounds like a bargain.
You think?
So, I mean, keep talking. I'll confirm that.
Yeah, because I'm trying to look it up now as I, you know, completely interrupt your train of thought there. But I guess, you know,
$402.
Okay.
That's the base cost. That's not weapons and stuff included.
Right.
Because you get a Knight Paladin out and it's what, about $450, something like that? So he's definitely going to be over that.
We talked about the Wave Serpent for a second. I'll go back to it. The Serpent Shield. Any damage suffered by a Wave Serpent from a ranged weapon is reduced by 1 to a minimum of 1.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. In addition, once per battle, a Wave Serpent can discharge its Serpent Shield. If it does so, roll a d6. On a 2+, the nearest visible enemy unit within 24 inches suffers d3 mortal wound. So it's like a smite.
Yeah. No, I'm all over it. I think that the Wave Serpents, they aren't going to have the place that they did, like, back in 6th edition.
Man, I don't know.
The fact that
they're not gunboats, really, but they are. They still have guns. But this durability of 13 wounds, toughness 7, and then being able to reduce everything by 1 with an armor save. These guys also have a 3+ armor save. It is incredibly durable.
You got a wound at 13 times.
Well, it's not going to be that thing that every 2 damage gun, like a Luda's Death Gun, is going to be able to take out. It's going to be the thing that, I mean, sure, you're going to survive the 1 or 2 or 3 damage things fairly well, but when someone rolls that 6, you know, or a 5, you're still taking a hefty sum of wounds. I think that the right weapon for the right job is still going to do the work. However, what's going to prohibit it from being as big as it was back in 6th edition is the price point. All the vehicles are much more expensive.
I'll give you that. There will be less of them on the table, but if you can commit to a Wave Serpent strategy, and there are plenty of things that fit in Wave Serpents very well. Heck, I mean, you could even probably make a case for Howling Banshees and of course, the Wraith Blades and that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I think they're good. Another standout thing, in my opinion, for the Eldar is the Night Spinner.
And Night Spinner's always been decent. at least in my experience.
If you could get lucky with it, then it was pretty good. The Doomweaver now is 48 inches, heavy 2d6. 2d6, that's strong. Strength 7, 2 damage. The weapon can target units that are not visible to the bearer, and if you roll a 6 plus for the wound, it's AP neg 4.
Yeah, that's strong. That's super strong.
So heavy 2d6, hitting on threes, indirect fire, 48 inches with the possibility of neg 4 saves.
I think that's definitely a very strong option. In a similar vein, like I look at something like the Sun Cannon, which was probably more popular in 6th edition. I think the Sun Cannon has a place again now.
What's that do?
The Sun Cannon is 48-inch range, heavy 2d6, strength 6, AP minus 3, d3 damage each.
Oh, that's true. But that comes on a Wraith Knight. How many points is that, like a million?
I'll get back to you on that. But I feel like it shoots farther than it has in the past.
Yeah, I think it used to be 36 or 24 inches or something like that. It was a fairly close. I could be misremembering. I mean, again, 7th edition is dead to me now, and so I remember none of the ranges. But I do remember it being used, but the Wraith Knight was always in my face when it was being used, so I don't think the range mattered.
Didn't matter because I was charging right after that.
Right.
Yeah, 118 points on the Sun Cannon, so definitely.
I'll take my chances with the Viper. Sorry, with the Night Spinner.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't hate the Fire Prism. I mean, the Night Spinner is cool, don't get me wrong, but I feel like you're relying on a lot of luck with the Doomweaver gun, and what kind of annoys me about
that. Average roll of 7?
No. I mean, I understand, but what I'm saying is, like, I feel like your target would change depending on, because, like, it's, you know, if no AP, I'm going to be shooting at these guys over here, but AP minus 4, I want to be shooting at this, and you're just not 100%
that's valid.
That's
a valid concern.
Yeah, so that has me a little concerned. But the Fire Prism, I do want to point out the Fire Prism. The Prism Cannon, I love. I love anytime you can get a gun on a vehicle that has multiple firing modes because it gives you versatility without paying more. And
with the Prism Cannon, it's 0 points. So when you talk about not paying more,
yeah,
I mean, that seems pretty that seems pretty good when it comes to price comparisons.
Well, yeah, somebody
in
told
this
me the
world. I mean, there's value there. I mean, let's not even talk about how a plasma pistol costs less than an Angela's bolt gun. I don't want to talk about that right now. But in this world, if you can find a value in what Chris just said of a lower cost war gear equivalent that still does good stuff, That plays into the efficiency of the model.
Yeah, absolutely. And yep. I like that. I like the Fire Prism over the Night Spinner just because it gives you options on what you're going to shoot at, and you can pick the appropriate weapon or the appropriate firing mode for what you're shooting at.
It does have 60-inch range.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even the heavy D6, like the quote-unquote weakest version of that, is AP minus 3. Yeah, it's only 1 damage each. But against a unit like against a unit like Death Company or generic Marine unit A, B, or C that's got a bunch of one wound models, you're forcing these guys to take some really, really tough saves.
Yeah,
I wish that focus shot was 3 shots all the time and not a D3. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah,
I think that's part of where, I mean, if it was always 3 shots, then it would be stupid broken for 0 points. That randomness has got to factor into that.
Fair.
What I've noticed, it feels to me like, from what I've been seeing, it feels like if it's D3, it was kind of like a small blast. If it was a D6, it's kind of like a large blast. That's kind of how I feel, like, exactly. In my head. And yeah. After putting like 8 Lehman Russes on the table the other day and just rolling 100 dice a turn, after the initial, oh my God, how many dice do I have to roll to get through this turn? After getting over that initial shock, I was having a lot of fun rolling all those dice. I'm not going to lie. Even when I just rolled like a 2
and
on my hit.
And not having to walk across the table and not having to say, hey man, could you
place
put this
the
template
blast
where it's going to hit the most of your guys? No, dude, move it over where it actually hits all
exactly.
Your guys. You
know? No, the small circle has to be over your base. No, get that off of my model. I worked very hard on that model. Please get that blast marker off that model.
it's interesting that you guys say that because I had an experience like this, and it was supposed to be a fairly casual game. And as soon as that blast template, it was a Scorpius, a Whirlwind Scorpius, and I was shooting some strength at AP3 stuff at some bikes, and they were clumped together fairly well. We spent a good amount of time just debating over how many exactly fit under that template. And at the end, you know, when someone says to you, I feel like you were kind of gaming me there, and you're thinking, whoa. I mean, on the one hand, you want to get as many dudes as you can. On the other hand, like, when you're trying to be as accurate as possible, the time, the sheer time investment to create that kind of experience for somebody.
That's when people want, I just like, look, man, we don't have to guess here. We have this physics, we have physical things we can just look at. Let's not debate it. Let's just put it down.
Yeah. And I just kind of backed up and said, all right, you know, it wasn't a tournament match. Not a big deal, you know, but it's something that I remember. It's like, oh man, like how I'm approaching this, however I'm approaching this is giving somebody a feel bad experience. And it's just, I'm using my eyes.
It's amazing how much that 2 foot difference across the table, you know, from where your model is versus where he's seeing it, you know, that 4 foot gap between you can change perspective on a blast marker by so much. But, you know, I think, hey, kudos to GW. You've taken out a good quarter of the arguments at a tournament.
Yeah, dude. So I'm not going to miss that conversation.
No, absolutely I'm not either. Not.
Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about some more of the Xeno stuff, and then some, if we have time, we'll talk about ways that we've found to increase your odds of reserve charging.
Cool. Sounds good.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Ricky and Chris.
Knitting the narrative.
Oh man, I can't.
We're going down Xeno's special rules, I guess the base army rules and how what they've changed to for Warhammer 40K 8th edition. And the next one we're going to talk about is the Dark Eldar.
Now, the what?
Yep. I'm sorry, the Drukhari.
All right. Sorry. I was confused there for a second.
Dark Eldar. as we heathen Terrans call them.
Mm.
All Drukhari units with the ability power from pain get an ability based on the round of the game. They call it the battle round. Round one, each time they suffer an injury on a 6, it ignores the injury and the wound is not lost. Yeah, so it rolls a d6 each time a model with this ability suffers a wound. Could ignore it.
And
that's turn one.
And that's also mortal wounds.
Yeah, any wound. You are correct. On battle round two, so these are cumulative. So as the rounds progress, you're going to get this stack up of abilities for all the Dark Eldar you've got still alive on the table. So round two, eager to flay. You can reroll the dice when determining how far the unit with this ability moves when it advances or charges.
Yep. Well,
there we go.
So
what I heard was eager to fillet because I'm a little but I think that really the meaning doesn't change all that much.
Okay, well, think about witches right now. Let's think about a unit of witches.
Which unit?
That one. That have now become, 17% more survivable. And they've doubled their odds of making a charge.
And that goes right back into what I was saying about the Gene Stealer cult. These models, anytime you can get that bonus to charging, or like orcs with Here We Go, like you're seeing assault come back right now. This is how they're doing it.
The speed of the units are fast. They're much faster than what their movement stat. In some of these cases, the movement stats are higher or whatever, they're adjusted, but the units are going to move faster than just what their base stat entry says because of the pylons, because of the advances, because of the charge and the phantom inch and the consolidates.
And the disembark distance. I mean, you're getting out 3 inches, then you're moving.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff is going to add up to where models are going to basically seem like they're teleporting across the table. And it's hard to be safe from assault now. It's way hard to be safe from assault.
And I think that's, how you said earlier that a case could be made for Howling Banshees. I think that you just made the case for Howling Banshees as a counter assault unit because they're swinging first. And I think that's something that will be very important with how many armies now are going to get to reroll these charges and get up in your face and then charge you on turn two at a minimum. They're going to get you at turn two. it'd be nice to have some Howling Banshees up there that you're not having to burn command points just to attack first. To deal with a lot of these, charges.
Now I know someone's going to point out we missed something from Dark Eldar here, and I apologize, but we're just kind of going over not the combos per se right now, just how these base army rules have changed. So number three, the Flensing Fury. You can add.
I like this one.
Yeah, you can add 1-2 hit rolls made from a unit with this ability in the fight phase.
So anyone that was hitting on a 3+ earlier is now hitting on a 2+.
Yeah, so that's battle round 3, battle round 4. Units with this ability automatically pass morale test. It says, do not roll the dice.
So, killing them early is going to be super important.
I wonder why it says, do not roll the dice. Is there something in here? Do they get anything for, like, failing or rolling super well on their morale?
I'm not sure. There may be something where you can force a reroll or you neg the what do you mean the auto pass? It means I always roll an 8 because if I had a -1 or a +1 to the morale check, that's what it is. If I automatically pass, let's say I would always count as automatically rolling an 8 or something, and then you give me a +1, then I'd lose by 1. But if I never roll the die, then your modifier doesn't stack.
I think we're reading too much into it. Just don't roll a die. You passed it.
Well,
move on.
Well, I'm saying that's why they're telling you not to roll.
Yeah. Die. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the last one, it's 5+ from here on, is at the Mantle of Agony. Subtract 1 from the leadership of enemy units that are within 6 inches of any units with this ability in the morale phase.
It's good.
Yeah.
That's because, again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier. That right there, you just lost 1 additional model.
Yeah.
You take that morale test. That's the way I look at those right there every single time.
So you saw it cumulative. Bunch of bonuses. You're kind of encouraged to have a bunch of some of these units on the table that can do things like rerolling charges past turn 2 or even in turn 2 and beyond.
So basically what we've learned here is just like in 7th edition, just kill the Dark Eldar turn 1 or 2 so we don't have to worry about 3/5 of their rules.
Well, I mean, let's talk about a Venom, you know, for instance, you know, and the Dark Eldar vehicles, because vehicles, again, are a lot more survivable. A Raider has 10 wounds. Now, look, when it takes 5 wounds, its movement stat goes from 14 to 10. But 10
is still a pretty decent distance.
Yeah, I agree. It's got a 5+ invulnerable save and a 4+ armor save. That's a Raider on 10 wounds, toughness 5.
I mean, that thing is always going to get a save. You cannot understate how powerful it is to have a model that always gets a save. Even if it's just a 5+, I mean, we're looking at percentages. There's going to be times where you're heavy hitting wounds are not going to get to the roll to see how many you get stage. I ran into that problem with a big mech in a power field on a, now I'm trying to remember, I'm getting all my Xenos mixed up, battle wagon. That's the one.
Well, the Raider also and the Venom, I know we're talking about the changes, but it has the fly special rule. The Raider and the Venom both had the fly. And why that's super important fly is they can scoot out of combat. I believe they can fall back out of combat, right? They can fly.
With fly, you can fall back and still shoot your weapons.
Yep. They can, if you needed to, let's say you wanted to put the shock prowl on this thing, you could engage airborne units if there was some reason to do so. Maybe they're limping around with a couple of wounds.
Do they still have that ram thing? That's
the shock prowl. It's a, right. It's a,
what does that do?
-1/1 damage.
Their base strength 6. I mean, that ain't bad.
You can make a maximum of 1 close combat attack with the shock prowl. But, you know.
Oh, and if you charge, it's a D3 damage.
Yeah, D3 instead of 1.
ABC, always be charging. That's right. My motto. Why would you not? It's there. It would be rude not to.
The last thing for the base rules I want to touch on is the combat drugs. I won't read what they are, but the novel thing here is it says, roll or pick, your choice. Then everybody with the combat drugs gets that.
Yeah, I predict a lot of people just rolling. I'm just kidding. No. I don't predict that ever happening.
No.
that's really cool.
Hook me up with that Hypex +2 move.
Yeah. Hey, Dark Eldar players, make little tokens so that you put those where they go, and that way I know.
More hats.
We need pointy hats, though. These should have pointy hats and probably, like, I don't know, a skull or something on it. But that's cool because it's like, oh, you know, this unit I want to do this with. Well, let me give it +1 weapon skill, or, you know, this one I need to be super fast. So I like that because you know exactly what you're going to give them. You can tailor your list to work with those combat drugs.
Again, you know, we're not talking army list combos. We're just kind of going over the base rules. The next one up would be the Harlequins. And this is, while the Harlequins have a lot of cool stuff, and I mean a lot, they've got weapons that have decent strength. They've got abilities that let you reroll wounds and stuff. I mean, they have a lot of power. Harlequins are incredibly strong in 8th edition. I think that they've kind of done it right way to make them intimidating and scary, whereas before they were, I mean, just such lackluster, nowhere near what they were in second edition. I think they're kind of back to it. Their big ability here is the rising crescendo. Units with this ability can advance and charge in the same turn. In addition, they can fall back and still shoot and or charge in the same turn.
That's fun. That's real fun.
You're never going to lock these guys down.
Yeah.
Well, let me also go to the fact to say that a troop, the base troop for these guys, the unit,
that's never going to get
and
old.
The battlefield role, right, have a movement of 8. And so with an advance, you know, it turns their movement into an average of 11 and a half inches. And then with a reroll, the advance, what does that put the average up to? 5 inches. So they're looking at...
I just love the idea, Paul, of these troops just like coming across the battlefield and then... You know, you've got your infantry out there as a screen, and like you're in Lord of the Rings when the undead in the Return of the King, they finally come out and they just mow through the entire army. These guys are just going to come out, they're going to charge in, and then they're just going to fall back, and they're just going to go through them and then charge into the next guys.
Now, if the troops are the army of the dead from Lord of the Rings, then the solitaire is Yoda from Episode 2.
Well, let's go through this.
Yes.
With an average roll of, 13, 14 or whatever, with a reroll in advance and then being able to charge with a rising crescendo, advance and then charge in the same turn, that could be a potential lightning strike across the table. The solitaire has a movement of 12.
And someone gave him some extra caffeine shots in his mocha.
The basic Harlequin has a 4+ invulnerable save. The solitaire has a 3+. Yeah, and then once per battle, instead of making a normal move with the solitaire, you can make the blitz move. If you do so, add 2d6 to the model's move characteristic.
This guy is going to be, I think, the best assassin in 8th edition.
Yeah, in addition, the model's attacks characteristic is increased to 10. He has 8 attacks.
And he hits on 2s.
Yeah, he has 8 attacks normally.
Golly.
10 hits on 2s. I was watching him on the GW Twitch channel, where he basically... hopped over everything and then deleted a Tech Magos Dominus.
He can get the Harlequin's Caress, which is strength 5, negative 2 AP, and does 1 damage. But that negative 2, when you're swinging 10 attacks, hitting on 2s, strength 5. Strength 5 is big. Strength 5 wounds most things, you know, reliably.
On a 5+. Yeah. Even an Imperial Knight is wounded on a 5+ with a strength 5 weapon.
Yeah, that is big.
He's on, okay, so the Solitaire, I think we all have to agree, is Dark Eldar, and he is on all of the combat drugs at the same time.
let's not cross the streams yet. We'll do that when we get to Yanari.
He should seek counseling. That's all I'm saying.
He may have an issue. No, the Solitaire, he's brutal. He is what you want. He is absolutely brutal.
I never wanted to play, these guys, but geez. That is, Harlequins look fun. Well, I just want to move this guy across the table.
With
and,
their ability to
and
get
laugh
all
at
that
people.
Movement, and with their 4+ invulnerable save, they're surprisingly durable.
3+ on the solitaire, too. He's got, 5 wounds with a 3+ save. He's going everywhere he wants. He's killing whatever he wants.
He's a single model.
Yeah.
He's a single model, which means he's extremely easy to hide.
He's gonna jump over your Land Raider and then hide behind it as he kills all the troops.
He's gonna jump in and charge your Land Raider, so your Land Raider has to back off and doesn't get a shoot. And then on the next turn, he's going to jump around and charge something else. He's just,
Land Raiders don't have the behemoth rule or whatever where they can.
No, they don't have
the Titanic rule. Yeah, they're not Titanic. It's Titanic rule, right? Titanic.
There's a couple different ways they go about it.
Yeah, either way,
it's not a Spartan, which is unfortunate, but I am very excited for the Spartan sidebar.
I think everyone is. But yeah. The Land Raider's closer now. Either way,
the Troop Master, all friendly mask units that are within 6 inches of this model in the fight phase can reroll failed wounds.
Doesn't seem awful.
No. He's a 5-wound character with an invul. Yeah. The Solitaire is not a mask unit. I want to point that out. But all the other stuff in here is.
I don't think the Solitaire cares.
No, he doesn't need friends.
He's doing his own thing.
No.
Being able to take that caress on most of these guys to get that extra strength in the negative 2 AP is strong. In one of my test games, that's what, let's just say that was a problem for the Blood Angels.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Extreme what now? Rerolling wounds now? Negative 2?
No big deal.
Something's wrong here.
What?
Let me say, that's when I became the command point master. I'm going to burn a reroll. I'm going to interrupt the combat. I'm going to swing with this 10-man strong unit of death company.
You better. There ain't going to be many left.
No, yeah, I saw that coming down the pipe. Like, nope.
You should just put two of your command points with your opponent's Solitaire. That way you know where they're at, and when he gets close enough, you know that you're just going to use them.
But see, that's like, the way he's charging. Works.
Okay, here we go.
If he charges me, the opponent gets to choose who they activate first. So that's why I was talking about in the last episode where that, you know, you've got to be strategic with which one do you fire off first, just in case your opponent wants to come in with the interrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's extremely tactical. I mean, I remember during the game I played this week, my opponent was trying to decide whether he wanted his boys to swing first at my Sanguinary Guard or if he wanted the boys on the other side of the table to kill Lamartis, who was off by his lonesome after punching a truck. So that decision basically got to choose which of those units took damage, and he wanted to get Lamartis gone because of his auras, his reroll auras and the charge distances and all that other stuff. So I mean I proceeded to interrupt the other squad and really took the wind out of their charge.
And we see it in Age of Sigmar a lot, and it's kind of neat to see it come over to this side as well, where I've actually held back units from units that can charge. I've held them out of charging because I knew that I was going to activate and then he was going to activate, and that unit would probably get chewed up before they could make their charge. So now that's something that players will have to keep in mind. And Age of Sigmar doesn't have the command points, so 40K's got a need. It's like we're just throwing wrenches in every plan you have now. So it's kind of neat.
It matters. I'm pretty excited. It just adds that level of strategic play, which I think. Now look, you're going to probably be able to easily assess which combat is you want to fire off, which is the most important to you. Just do it. Make sure that's how you lead off every time.
Yeah. Just accept that you're going to lose some dudes now. I don't care how good you are in combat. You're going to lose some guys before all of your units swing.
So Yanari are the next one we'll talk about here. And again, we're just covering the top level stuff. The Strength from Death. This is still good. This is still, in my opinion, very good. The ability is common to all Yanari infantry and Yanari biker units and the Incarn. Each time a unit is completely destroyed within 7 inches of one or more units with this ability, except in the morale phase, pick one of those units to make a soul burst action. The unit can immediately do one of the following, even if it has already done so in the turn. The unit can move as if it were in the movement phase. It can advance or fall back as part of this move. The unit can, if it's a psyker, immediately attempt to manifest a single psychic power. So pretty strong. The unit can shoot as if it were a shooting phase, even if it's advanced or fell back. And then the unit can charge as if it were the charge phase, even if it advanced or fell back this turn. Enemy units can fire Overwatch as normal. A unit cannot do this if it's within 1 inch of an enemy unit. Here's the big one. The unit can fight as if it were the fight phase.
Yeah, so that pretty much gets rid of that whole problem with Inari in 7th edition. Well, not the whole problem. There were a lot of problems with Inari in 7th edition. Let me put a little asterisk on that. However, the idea that, I can go into a new combat, but I've already swung, because there's no more initiative steps to worry about.
This here, this is when it goes back into, you know, as far as like can assault if you didn't charge him or whatever. So you know, declare the right charges. But then it goes on to say, note, this means that a unit may be able to shoot or fight twice in the same turn. Just in case you weren't clear.
Yeah. Now, one thing now, I can't remember the exact wording on match play for Smite. Is this going to let me get off 2 smites?
Smite, you can cast multiple times.
You could cast
the same other power twice.
Right, so the other powers, I guess that's the question, is can I cast Ancestor's Grace, or just because I'm looking at it right here. Can I cast that
once per player turn or turn? You have to read that because you could fire this each time a unit is completely destroyed within 7 inches.
I mean, does it really matter? I mean, I'm going to cast Smite, so who cares about the rest of them? But, you know, if I got Smite, I'm smiting.
Yeah, fair enough. So, and then there's some stuff about transports, which units of this ability can embark on any Eldari transport, even though the transport in question might normally only permit models with other faction keywords to do so. All other restrictions apply normally. Yeah, there we go.
Yep, does not suck.
Nope. No. I think it's still strong. We will see a lot of Yanara units out there.
Yeah, it's still very similar. I don't think, you know, that's one thing I've noticed they've done a really good job with is they haven't changed, like inherently changed your army. Like, you know, what you know your army to be and to do, it's kept the same theme. Mechanically, it may have changed a little bit and the way in which it goes about it, but they've kept the same basic principle and just tightened it up. So
yeah, things are going to change, right? And you're going to want to include things that have more synergy, and you're certainly not going to be playing with as many vehicles, I don't think.
No, but goodness gracious, a single rhino now is the hardest thing I've ever tried to kill. So I don't need 13 of them like I did before. Three now will do some pretty good work.
Yeah, let's talk about Necrons is the final thing we'll wrap up with for now and how this works. The abilities they get, the reanimation protocols. You guys tell me if you think this is good. Roll a d6.
Yes.
Okay. For each slain, roll a d6 for each slain model in the unit, unless the whole unit has been completely destroyed at the beginning of your turn. On a 5+, the model's reanimation protocols activate and is returned to this unit. Otherwise, they remain inactive, although you can roll again at the start of each of your subsequent turns. When a model's reanimation protocols activate, set up the model in the unit coherency with any other model that is not, whatever, you get what I'm saying? Set it up in unit coherency.
Yeah, set up the model in unit coherency. Yeah, there's a typo there. Come on, editor.
It wasn't me this time.
But yeah, set up the model in unit coherency with any model from this unit that has not returned to the unit as a result of reanimation protocols this turn, and more than 1 inch from enemy models. But basically, it's a very long-winded but very specific way in which they have worded that so that we don't see those shenanigans like people used to do with the scarabs. If you all remember that, they would just chain the scarabs all the way across. Exactly. They're saying that you cannot do that now specifically in the rules. We don't have to FAQ it. We don't have to have TOs to do it or anything. It's right there. Good job, guys. I like the rule. I think it's very good. Yeah, actually, I just think it's better all around. From a Necron, we're going to stay here and we're never going away standpoint, I think it's better than the old version for a couple of reasons. One, you know, before it was basically, realistically, it just kind of boiled down to another save, right? Like, you know, hey, they saved, they're still here. And then, you know, their barge could maybe bring them back and stuff. But now, they could be wiped out to a man. Oh, I failed all my saves. Well, he sucks. Well, I'll just hide him behind this building. And if he doesn't get killed, guess what? When I get to do reanimation protocols, if I had a 10-man squad, I'm going to roll 9 dice. And on a 5 or up, they're coming back. And I'm doing this every turn until they're back up to full strength. You have to pump all your shooting into that unit. Because if you knock out 5 Necrons and you don't commit all the way, you just wasted your time.
Still a morale check too.
Well, I mean, and here's, well, and they're leadership 10, right? So it's not exactly like they're fighting against a poor leadership value. I've never understood the Necron's obsession with leadership 10. It makes no sense to me, except on the characters. Though, ironically,
unflappable.
Emotech the Stormlord has a worse leadership than a Necron warrior.
That makes sense to me. Why is he 9 and everything else is 10?
He knows when to get out.
You probably watched The Mummy.
That's what it is.
He watched The Mummy. He didn't like what happened to the bad guy at the end. But the
Fraser got him.
But the only thing about your assessment I disagree with, Ricky, is you said 10-man squads. I think we're going to be seeing like 3 20-man squads of warriors implacably advancing across the table with a bunch of cryptex behind giving them these rerolls. And if you do not finish these squads off, you will never get rid of them, period.
I think when they go bigger, though, I haven't looked all the way through them, but I better be seeing some stuff to ignore morale tests. You know what I'm saying? Because I understand your side of it. Because, yeah, if I don't kill all 20 of them, I'm rolling 19 dice. And yeah, there's definitely that side of it. But at the same time, if I kill 15 of them, morale test is going to get them anyway. So there's definitely going to be that.
Well, you have to commit to killing the 15 of them, and that's not necessarily easy with, you know, covers. Yeah, no,
exactly.
Else.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and if you are spending all of your time just trying to get rid of one warrior squad down to the last model, and it doesn't work, and the thing that's really hurting you that's still a fair distance away, you know, long range shooting power, like say annihilation barges, they've got all the DACA. You're not killing that, and you're trying to kill those warriors, the ones that are going to be swamping on objectives. Because remember, model count is the key for objective holding nowadays. Yep. You're just going to flip a lid when one guy turns back into 16 guys after a cryptic drops his
gives plus one. Add one to all reanimation protocols.
And then you get to re-roll it if he uses his resurrection orb.
Cryptek doesn't get one of those, but...
But an Overlord does, or a Lord does.
Destroyer Lords, and I can see a lot of Destroyer Lords out there in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So, basically, it's one of the... I think it's extremely thematic. I think it's the most thematic that that Necrons have ever been in terms of how they're portrayed in the fiction as these mindless, implacable hordes of things that just keep getting back up. So, and I'm glad that they kept it so that if the unit dies... You don't get any back, but at the same time, there's no phase out number like in third edition.
Yeah, I'm thankful I never played that version of Necrons because that always seemed like the dumbest rule in the world.
That's what you'd ask every time you roll on the table. What's your phase out number?
Yeah, that's what I heard. That everybody would know that number, and that's
and then
all.
If it sounded weird, you'd be like, "Let me count." See the army list.
Yeah, I like this one. I like this version. You're not laying models over on their sides and you know rolling everything and trying to keep track of all it. I feel like it speeds up the reanimation protocols to an extent. You know, it's basically just each you're just rolling each time. You can look at a unit. Oh, that was a 20 man unit. I've got 15 left. I'm gonna roll five dice. Okay, there's fives. Put the models back on the table. Move on to the next one. It's not this just every single.
It's better, especially since it's reoccurring.
Yeah.
You don't get one shot and you're out. The next one is Living Metal. At the beginning of your turn, this unit recovers one wound lost earlier in the battle. So a lot of the vehicles and the monolith and things of that nature have
the Satan?
The Living Metal.
Do they have that?
I can check right now.
Hold on, I'm going. Satan. You're talking about just like the shards, the Satan shards?
Yeah, any of them. They used to have Living Metal, if I remember correctly.
They do not. The Satan Shard, Nightbringer, Deceiver, do not.
Okay. Never mind me then.
The Monolith, Doomsday Ark, Annihilation Barge, those all have Living Metal.
Yeah, that Monolith has a Titanic rule. My Shadow Sword is going to gut a Monolith. Looking forward to it. And by my 7-year-old son's. He's getting a Shadow Sword.
Oh, yes, that you bought for quote unquote him.
Him, yes.
Right.
Yeah, his.
Wink, nudge, nudge,
I'm making air quotes in the air. His Shadow Sword will be amazing.
That's our Xenos rundown for now. I mean, I know we covered just the army base special rules and some of the things that stuck out to us, not necessarily combos. And I know there's stuff that we did not cover. I get that. But I'm interested to hear maybe what are some things that other people are already discovering that's helping them affect and build their list. Because what we haven't done in a while, because 7th edition had gotten to the point, had plateaued with creativity for army lists, I'll just say that. 8th edition is a brand new world. And I want to hear about your list that is 11 Venerable Dreadnoughts or 10 Venerable Dreadnoughts and two either Primaris Rhinos or Tech Marines.
We're going to talk about my 10 Ravenwing Dark Talon list. We're going to talk about that next time.
That sounds good.
Spoiler alert, it's pretty good.
I don't know about all that. I don't know about good, but it's there. It's there. It's possible.
You'll see. You'll see.
You guys got anything you want to add before we get out of here?
No, just you know, check out the FDN page. You know, Paul's going to be, I'm sure, putting up a lot of cool stuff from his trip to Warhammer World. So you guys stay tuned there. Check out the battle report that I just wrote.
We got a buddy coming who's going to do. We're going to stream him doing the two eating challenges there at Bugman's Bar.
Listen, I know it's wrong of me. I'm kind of hoping that he fails in spectacular fashion. Like,
leave it
you know
at that. But he's not going to. He's a beast.
No, he's going to do it, but I really just want to see, like, you trying to jump out of the way before bad things happen.
If we can get reliable Wi-Fi there, then we're definitely going to be doing some live streams. If not, I'll record it still.
Do they know that you're the Paul Murphy? Like, do you not have the GW, like, the Warhammer World Wi-Fi password now? Like, I feel like that place should be wired up for it.
I hope so. I hope they give it to me. I'll do everything I can to sweet talk him at the bar.
Yeah. Oh, hey, you know what? I do have one thing I want to say. Thank you to everybody at NashCon. We just come back from NashCon. They had their first ever Warhammer Age of Sigmar tournament down there, and it was a fantastic event. It wasn't huge. It was a 32-man event. It was fantastically run. It was one of the smoothest run tournaments I've ever been to, and fantastic people down there. So next year, everybody look that up.
Sweet, man. Check us out on YouTube. And I said over the next couple of weeks, we'll try to get some recording sessions, but the time zones may not link up exactly like we want. So we'll see what we can do. But there'll be stuff on YouTube. There'll be stuff on the Facebook page. And I do have a couple of things in the bank that I may try to release over that period of time if we aren't able to put a show together. Anyway, thanks a lot, guys. Have a good rest of y'all's night.
Yeah, cheers.
Good night.
I see dead people.